All right, everybody, welcome. Welcome to today's panel focused on the JPM Healthcare Conference of 2025, as well as biotech, biopharma, and health in the United States in general. Today's panel is sponsored by BioPharm Catalyst, the go-to resource for biopharm and biotech investing. BioPharm Catalyst provides key catalyst updates for publicly traded biotech and pharma companies. With a database encompassing thousands of catalysts, BPC provides real-time information on companies in the sector, as well as upcoming events, reports, and other catalysts for investors to perform informed investment decisions. I'm very happy to have both Christian and Olivia from the BioPharm team with us today to lend us their biotech investment expertise. Thank you for joining and sponsoring the show, Christian and Olivia.
Hey, Nick, this is John as well. I'm on. I'll be representing BioPharm Catalyst as well. Olivia and Christian are on too. We will probably all be speaking at various points, but really appreciate you having us all on.
Hey, I appreciate you sponsoring the show, making it possible, and participating. That last one is huge. I'm excited to get some of your guys' takes today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
So here at the top, I'm going to run through a couple of just disclaimers in general to keep you safe in your investment decisions to those of you who are listening. Now, as we will be discussing the potential for individual investments, it's important to note that each of your individual circumstances are different. So you need to make sure that you read about each investment carefully so that it fits your specific risk and return profile. Also note that nothing in this space should be directly construed as actionable financial advice or a solicitation to buy or sell any security or derivatives thereof. Always conduct your own research or discuss with your licensed financial advisor before making or taking any given investment. Now, with that said, before I hit the rest of these introductions, those of you who have come to our panels before know that I like to keep everything fluid and wide open for discussion. So if you have anything to add, my beloved panelists, to anything that another panelist says, feel free to chime in. The only thing I ask is give it a little bit of breath between when the prior former speaker finishes before you jump in, just to avoid any overlap or background feedback. Now, with that said, I'm going to jump into the rest of our panelists that we have with us today. First, we've got Christian Angermeyer, an investor and entrepreneur within the biotech market sector, founded Apeiron Investment Group, a private investment firm focused on life sciences, fintech, future tech, bio, and hospitality. They've got over $2.5 billion in assets under management, and we're excited to have your insight today again. Thanks for joining us, Christian.
Thanks for having me, and welcome, everybody.
We've also got Dr. Jason Fung back again. He's well-versed and rightfully renowned for his work in disease prevention. He's often called the founder of intermittent fasting. Dr. Fung has prescribed intermittent fasting and low-carb, high-healthy-fat diets for the management for, and even at times the reversal of, type 2 diabetes. He's authored numerous books on disease prevention, such as The Cancer Code, and we're honored to have him joining us today. Now, with that said, I'm going to jump right into things here while we work on continuing to get the rest of our panelists up here. And just to kind of keep the floor wide open, I want to start with you, John, and then Christian and Olivia. All things considered, before we get to the detailed topics, what were some of your key takeaways from the conference that you think are pretty important to be privy to? Let's start with John on this one.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. Obviously, JP Morgan conference is the kind of premier and biggest healthcare conference of the year for 3 or 4 days. The entire globe is really focused on healthcare out in San Francisco in the U.S. So it's always a really exciting time of year. And I always like to say that while, you know, there definitely were some big deals that came out of the conference, really what I think is important about the conference is that it sets the stage for what's going to be happening in 2025 for biotech and for biotech investors. So it gives everyone a little bit of a guideline around you know, what to be focused on, what the general outlook is going to be for the year, and, you know, what key therapeutic areas, what indications to be looking at, and more specifically, you know, which players are possibly going to come out on top. I would say, just generally speaking, the tone for the conference was, and, you know, I know this phrase gets utilized quite a bit, but cautiously optimistic. I do think that 2024, at least from like an investor standpoint, was a little bit of a disappointing year in biotech. I think people were, you know, excited about the year going into it. But from the from the perspective of investing, the XBI was only up about 1% over the year, which was, you know, a little bit of a disappointment, especially coming off of a north of 7% return in 2023. I think just some of the big themes from the conference and things to kind of be focused on for folks is that, you know, consolidation and M&A is definitely going to be a focus, particularly for the large biotech companies. I do believe that this is going to be, based on what we saw at the conference, this is going to be favored over traditional IPOs. And this isn't too dissimilar from what we've seen in the past. The IPO market, you know, in the last several years has not been quite as hot as it was pre-pandemic. We're not having hundreds of biotech companies IPOing. And I do think consolidation and M&A is going to continue. You saw the big deal that Johnson & Johnson struck at the conference for $15 billion. They will acquire Intracellular Therapies for $132 per share in cash. So it's one of the largest deals that we've seen in quite some time. As a matter of fact, I don't think that we've seen a deal north of $5 billion in biotech in the last 6 years. Those deals, I still do think are going to be, you know, somewhat few and far between. I don't think that deals like that happen every single day. Having said that, I do think you are going to see a lot more of the larger biotech companies focus on late stage companies that have late stage drugs or drugs with proven science. I think that is the route we're going now, as opposed to some of these other acquisitions we've seen in the past for, you know, preclinical or earlier stage biotech companies from an acquisition standpoint. So I think, you know, consolidation in M&A is going to be something that we're going to continue to see. And I think that is certainly very exciting. I also think that there is going to be a continued focus on AI, on gene therapy, and on, to some degree, on GLP-1 and obesity. Olivia, I don't know if do you want to touch on that for a quick second?
Sure. Yeah, I definitely think that JPM this year just went ahead and proved that AI and biotech, in this specific example, is not going away anytime soon. It's definitely something that biotech firms and then larger pharma firms are trying to utilize and really use that technology to improve their development of different drugs or also in diagnostics. I mean, NVIDIA was at the conference and struck 3 different deals. And this is just another time that they actually attended JPM. So it's really going to be hard to separate AI and biotech as we move forward. I think they're just going to become one of the same. And that's going to start to really fuel some of the catalysts we're going to see moving forward. But Christian, did you have any other thoughts, any other takeaways?
Okay, but so my view, like, share everything you just said. Like, I think what also was talked about, and I think people are more confused than they should be. I'm just in Washington and was here for the inauguration. People are still a little bit confused what the new government will bring for biotech and pharma. My take is very clear, and I think it's underappreciated in markets. The new government will be extremely good for biotech, so for especially like smaller cap, like everybody who has drugs in development, because I think they're gonna cut down bureaucracy and overburdening regulation. So if you are about, or if you're in the process of creating drugs, the new government will be good for you. I think the new government will be rather bad for whoever has already approved drugs. So pharma companies because they want a very simplified set cut down pricing. But I think that trade actually that the Trump administration, in my point of view, will be very positive for biotech has not arrived yet. I think people, especially weirdly in the biotech industry, so I'm an sort of a little bit of an outlier because I'm very, again, optimistic and positive on this new government. But the biotech industry was all about, like we don't like him, blah, blah, blah. And I think with all these emotions they sort of have, and I don't want to make any political statement, but like with all these emotions they have, I don't think they see actually the very positive transformative power of the Trump administration and the positive sort of momentum it will give back to biotech, because then that's dialy needed. Because as John said before, like last year was very disappointing. The industry is actually, if I look at my portfolio, which is broader than just biotech, we do a lot in crypto, we do a lot in tech, is actually kind of the last sector which hasn't recovered. And I think it should, because like it's very like crypto, also interest rate sensitive, they are coming down, whatever. So, and I think Trump, short version, can give a very important impulse and momentum this year for biotech.
This is a third question. So another aspect I would like to emphasize from JP Morgan is like a lot of companies, like the like big companies in pharma, they're looking to diversify their portfolio, because their patent cliff is coming to an end for some of the drugs, let's say mainly in 2026, 2027, and 2028. So it's something just to keep in mind that many of these companies are looking, they have like enough firepower just to diversify that, like around $1.3 trillion. So yeah, it's something that would be interesting to see how like the mergers and acquisitions increase over the next following years, because 65% of most of the big pharma companies comes from like acquisitions, in terms of like how they the structure of their revenue, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and Christian, just to emphasize, first of all, both Christian's very good points, and I can kind of I'll kind of touch on both of them as well. So Christian from BPC was just referring to some of the patent cliffs that are coming up, and there's actually a statistic that by I think 2033, there's projected to be about $400 billion in revenue kind of up for grabs as patents are expiring. So I think that really makes the case for these companies being very, very specific in how they want to, you know, add to their current pipelines, right? And I think from an investor standpoint, you know, it's hard to determine, okay, well, which companies are actually going to get acquired. But it, you know, from a licensing standpoint, like I said, there's quite a bit of opportunity up ahead as some of these patents are expiring. And I think that's going to even, you know, to what Christian had said, to further bolster the M&A and the deal market. Other Christian's earlier point on some of the regulatory stuff, I mean, there was still a lot of question marks coming out of JP Morgan with respect to regulatory. Obviously, the conference took place before the inauguration of Trump in the U.S. I think that it does sound like a lot of the big, from what we heard from some of the CEOs of some of the larger biotech companies, they are definitely much more willing to work with the administration this time around than say the last time around. You might have some ambiguity and some question marks around, you know, how vaccines are going to be treated, obviously with RFK Jr. in there as the U.S. Health Secretary. So I think that, you know, firms like Pfizer or Johnson & Johnson, there might be some question marks around there. But from everything we heard, it sounded like, you know, they didn't think it was going to be a problem. And they've worked with tons of administrations in the past and have been able to get through it. What'll be interesting to see is kind of how something like the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA, unfolds, and, you know, what comes out of that, and you know how that may or may not change. I think one thing in particular that I had seen was a lot of industry stakeholders are looking for a repeal of the pill penalty, which is essentially a provision in the IRA that reduces the period of exclusivity for small molecule drugs to 9 years while biologic drugs get 13 years. So, you know, some of those kind of nuanced provisions of that act and sort of how drug pricing in general is treated with the administration, those will be some key things for investors to watch out for. So I just wanted to add that color.
For sure. And there's actually a ton of topics there that I want to unpack. Before I start diving into them in turn here, I just wanted to touch on one of the major topics that kind of loomed over the conference as a whole, and even sparked protests during the event, just accusing the industry as a whole prioritizing profits over patients. And so I'm curious, how are healthcare companies or even practitioners at large responding to public concerns about ethical practices? Is there potential for change for the benefit of patients expected? Dr. Fung, I'd love your take on that one.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yep, you sound great.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of, this RFK Jr. and so on, is to look at a lot of these issues other than sort of pharmaceuticals. The what's refreshing, I think, about him is that he's looking at other things, that is ultra processed foods, vaccines, additives like, fluoride. Like, these are determinants of health other than drugs, because for so long, everything is focused on drugs. And it's partially because I think of, the way that we're treated, we're taught, we're like, okay, well, we're just going to teach doctors to, what drugs to use and what surgery to use. And that's it. That's the limit of health. But it's not, right? There's so many other things that are important, from microplastics to, herbicides and pesticides and all these other things that can actually impact health. Just as a obvious thing, if you look at countries in the world, America has by far and away sort of the most obesity. Is it because Americans are lazy and want to be overweight? Obviously not. There's something in the environment, in Europe, in Asia, for example, that is much less conducive. And really, what's been pointed out is that a lot of the additives to food are not, they're banned in other countries. Like even Canada, like you have additives to your milk that are banned in Canada and Europe. So that's what's refreshing. And that's what I think people mean when they're talking about prioritizing patients over profits, because the big profit center, obviously, is drugs. So developing an Ozempic is the key to getting rich, but not necessarily the key to good health. There's a lot more to it than that. And I think that's where we're going to see a bit of a renewed focus and maybe a little bit away from, opening up the floodgates to new medications that may or may not be beneficial. There's so many examples of drugs that are sort of marginally beneficial that get approved by the FDA for no good reason. A lot of people talk about conflicts of interest. A lot of FDA, the people at the top of the FDA, they go, when they finish, they go and work for a big pharma for a big payday. A lot of the government, the studies that are, inform our evidence-based medicine, they're all done by drug companies. So there's a lot of conflicts of interest there that are going to get a lot of scrutiny. And that's where, I think people are rightfully a little bit cautious about where sort of these big pharmaceuticals, like what's the payoff at the end? Is it going to get approved? Because, if now we're focused on, additives to our food, there's going to be less potential for profit for cranking out, yet another drug that is not the focus of this administration. And I guess this is probably the first time ever that anybody at the highest levels of government has focused on this, because, the United States allows all kinds of crap into their food system that nobody else in the world allows. right? And is it because of these conflicts of interest? Is it that nobody cared and people were just cared about other stuff? Potentially, but it could make a big difference to our health. You know, as an investor, you have to be aware that perhaps these things are not going to be so easy, like drug approvals and that sort of thing are not going to be as easy going forward.
Thank you, Jason. I want to kick this one around the panel a little bit. Let's start with Christian A. Do you have anything to add to Dr. Fung there?
No, it was a very good summary. I would say there is a lot of education to be done from sort of our side, from the industry side, biotech and pharma alike, towards the government, because like it's very always easy to say, oh, look at these high drug prices, that's the problem. I think the whole, and by saying that as a non-American who has a lot of admiration for America, but the healthcare system is truly messed up in many, many ways. It starts like doctors prescribing, wrongly incentivized to prescribe stuff like too much. It's not just the drug pricing. It's a short version, but it's drug pricing is always the simplest thing to attack. I think maybe that government has truly, for the first time, as the previous speaker said, like they're focusing on it on the highest level, and they have maybe truly the first time the chance to really change it. I think the most important change will be what was said already, is to start and keep people healthy. And by the way, this can be also with the help of medication, but like keep people healthy. So practically change the definition of medicine in its core. I don't know if people here on the call know. I didn't know since a year ago until I dived into it. Where does actually our definition of medication coming from? Who's a doctor, whatever? We take it as God given. It was defined in the 1920s in a report commissioned by the government. Was called Flexner Report. This was the guy who did it. Because before, everything was sort of, you could call yourself a doctor without any education. You could prescribe stuff like snake oil, whatever. So it was very important that this regulation came. But this regulation did one kind of very narrow definition. When they defined what is actually illness in medicine, they said illness is if you have a negative deviation from the norm. And they defined that just when somebody is ill, has a so-called negative deviation from the norm, then medicine is allowed, which is defined as something which cures or helps that negative deviation from the norm. So if we talk about cancer or whatever, I think it's very obvious. It's the right description. You have cancer, you want to heal it, you want to become sort of healthy again, or if you have a virus in yourself. But as one example back then, being gay, was not the norm. So being gay was defined an illness, which is obviously not. So I wanted to show how tricky and slippery slope it can be, the definition. And it also completely shut the door for any preventative healthcare measures where we say, why do we actually all have to wait till a patient gets sick in the first place? Yeah, why can't we, and the whole entire healthcare system, why can't the whole system focus more on keeping people healthy in the first place? And that is, I think, the big change this government will bring, which, by the way, is not necessarily negative, because, like, for example, if you take GLP-1s, they actually have been found extremely positive to actually prevent not just like obesity, but prevent a lot of other negative problems. I think, by the way, coming to my topic, my passion topic is psychedelics. That's always my favorite example of what I mean. Like my company Atai is developing psychedelics for treatment of mental health issues like depression, anxiety, addiction. But ideally, we would never get depression or whatever in the first place. Yeah, and I think and I hope that the system will change. People will take things like psychedelics precautionary and preventatively, which would make society as a whole a much sort of healthier community.
Well said, Christian. Before I move along, do Olivia, Christian M, or John have anything to add to the preventative health topic?
The only thing that I'll add, I think that that Christian and Dr. Fung did a really great job of summarizing that. I mean, I can just talk about it just in light of some of the GLP-1 stuff, just because that's been a major focus. If anybody remembers back, you know, a couple months ago, there was the CEO of Novo had to testify before Congress and was, sort of grilled by Senator Bernie Sanders just with, related to how expensive, particularly Wegovy, was for U.S. consumers, really. I think the list price was $1,300 a month, whereas in countries like Germany, it was $140 a month and $92 in the U.K. So obviously somewhat prohibitively expensive in the United States. I think it does definitely speak a little bit to, kind of the broken healthcare system that we have in the U.S. Obviously, their argument essentially was that they were only recouping, 40% of the price after rebates and paying manufacturers within the supply chain. And then that price was also further reduced by negotiations within the Inflation Reduction Act. So I think their argument is that, it's almost kind of like fix the system, fix the problem a little bit, right? And there certainly is some truth to that. So I think it'll be interesting to kind of see how that how that all plays out in terms of, again, how the actual system, how the actual system is able to change over the course of the next, one, two, to 5 to 10 years from now, even in terms of how much money these companies are making off of these. Off of these drugs. I think the other point, and Dr. Fung was alluding to it a little bit, is that it, particularly within the US, obesity is, and I don't know the exact figure, Dr. Fung may know this a little bit better than me, but obesity is the root cause of hundreds of other diseases. So I think the idea, right, is that if they are able to solve that problem, they are then solving tons of other problems when it comes to other diseases and other indications. And I think that is sort of the counter argument there is trying to get to the root of this major problem within the US. And if we do this, then there's going to kind of be like a trickle down effect where other disease may not be as prevalent. Again, it may not solve everything, but it certainly would be a good launch point for the US. So I think those are just kind of two points. Just in the light of what we've seen with GLP-1. And I think that has been a lot of the focus of some of this pricing conversation that you mentioned, Nick.
For sure. And I want to go down this pathway a little bit here, since it was a major topic both at the conference and it's been a major topic of some of our other biotech and biopharm panels here, is that generally, the big pharma lobby suffered quite a major blow when the Biden administration pushed through Medicare's drug price negotiation law. But at the conference, numerous executives pointed to Trump's tax cut promises and a crackdown on pharmacy benefit managers as signs of new policies that would actually benefit the industry. But in fact, just I think last Friday or the Friday before, the Biden administration announced 15 additional drugs that included both Ozempic and Wegovy that'll face Medicare price negotiations under the IRA. And these two drugs alone account for $41 billion, I think it was, in annual Medicare spending. So the potential's there for sure for significant savings, I'd say, depending on how things move forward from a policy point of view. So, Dr. Fung, I'm wondering if you could shed just a little bit of light for our listeners today on how such drugs and the companies who make them may be affected here. And I'm also curious on your thoughts from the consumer patient side of things.
Yeah, so Ozempic is one of these drugs that is, like, I think there's an issue, right? They're very effective, obviously, but there's a lot of enthusiasm for them because obesity is sort of it contributes to a lot of problems. So type 2 diabetes, heart disease, kidney disease, blindness, strokes, cancer, there's 14 cancers, for example, that are considered obesity associated cancers. So breast cancer, colorectal cancer. So very important cancers that are considered obesity associated cancers. And some of this, associated this data with obesity and cancer is relatively new. It actually was really just brought to light about year 2000. So it's not like it's not like, so that's about 20 years ago. So it's not like it's something that people appreciate as much as they sort of should, but it plays a huge role in so many other diseases. And of course, the two biggest killers of Americans are cardiovascular disease and obesity. So, cardiovascular and cancer. And so if obesity and type 2 diabetes are sort of major inputs into those two diseases, then that's going to have a huge impact on healthcare spending. A couple of things about Ozempic is that, one, it's that as an investable sort of paradigm, I don't know if it's completely played out, because you got to understand that this class of drugs is not new. So it's actually been around forever. So Byetta was the first of these GLP-1 agonists. And it was, I think, approved by the FDA in 2005. So we're talking about 20 years ago, it was approved. And it was a twice a day injectable medication, so not that effective. And there wasn't that much weight loss. Then they developed a once a day injection, which was called liraglutide. And a bit better weight loss, but, you know, again, kind of inconvenient. So semaglutide, which is Ozempic, got developed as a once a week sort of more convenient drug. But then they saw huge weight loss. So that's the thing. So if you're talking about patent expirations and stuff, like everybody's, the drug is ancient. The drug class is ancient, 20 years old. So there's tons of copycat drugs on the market. They're all coming down the pipes. You know, you already got Mounjaro, which is a bit more effective than Ozempic. So how much more money are you going to make in these Ozempics? Like, that's one question. The other question is, we're starting to see a lot of concerns about other side effects, and also how many people stay on this drug. So if you look at Ozempic, there's this large study out of Kaiser Permanente where they looked at people who prescribed the medication, how many are still on it in a year. It's only about 25%. So it's pretty low. And, you know, I prescribe it a lot because, you know, my patients are mostly older. They're mostly overweight. They're mostly diabetic because I'm a kidney specialist. And there are also kidney benefits to it. So I actually prescribe it a lot. Nobody really likes to take it. Like, either they don't get the side effects, but then they don't lose weight. Because if you get the nausea, the vomiting, that's how the drug works. It makes you nauseated, so you don't feel like eating. So if you don't get the side effects, you don't get any benefits. If you get the side effects, you do get the benefits, but boy, you're not happy about it. So I sort of think that 25% is actually not too far off of what you're seeing in the real world, which is that a ton of people don't take the maximum doses or wind up coming off of it. So you're not seeing those sort of amazing benefits that you're you thought you'd get. And the other, so you have obviously new people coming on board, but there's a lot of people who are on board who are coming off. So I don't know how much that is. And then the other risk with that story is sort of there's a couple of new papers talking about depression and suicidal risk. And that highlights a concern that's been around not just for Ozempic, but really for all weight loss drugs. They've all had this sort of thing, because if you think about what they do, is they take away a lot of the enjoyment of eating. So if you people eat because they enjoy the food. If you don't enjoy the food and you it's okay for a few months, but year after year, if you can't enjoy the food, all of a sudden, you know, you're not feeling so happy. So there's always this concern. And there's a bit of data that's just come out recently in the last couple of months that's sort of described a bit of these risks of mental health issues, suicidal intention, and so on. So, you know, those are a couple of the things to do with the Ozempic. And of course, it's not the core problem, which is that it's not that Americans are deficient in GLP-1. There's something else that's causing the obesity. So we're not actually solving the root problem of what's causing the obesity. We're sort of masking it over by giving this other drug that is effective, right? I don't want to sound like I don't like it. I do like the drug, but there's something else going on. And what is it that's going on? Because obviously, if you could be like, if you look at, say, Italy is one of the countries in the world that has one of the lowest obesity rates. And they're, you know, a well-developed country, you know, it's not, or Japan has very low rates. Like, what can we do to actually fix what's causing it? Maybe it's the chemicals, maybe it's the environment, maybe it's something, but it's not a lack of willpower, right? That's what a lot of these sort of people always say, well, it's all about willpower. And like, no, it's not about willpower, right? This is one of the most destructive sort of attitudes that you see in a lot of these sort of calorie in, calorie out people, that it's all about what you eat and it's all about willpower. And like, no, obviously not. If you think about it, you have 70% of Americans who are overweight or obese, right? And this has been going up in the last couple of decades. So if you think about what's happening, so think about a, say you have, you're teaching 100 students and one student fails. Well, maybe that student, it's their fault. They didn't study. But what if 70 out of 100 students failed? Is it the student's fault or is it the teacher's fault, right? It's far more likely to be the teacher's fault than the student's fault. And we're in that same situation where we try to blame Americans for, oh, you're not exercising, you're not watching what you eat, you need to be smarter, you need to count your calories. No, it's something in the environment that is causing this problem, and we need to find out what it is, because it's not a lack of willpower.
Dr. Jason, if I might add here, because you're totally right, meaning, again, I live between Europe and the US, and my mini study of N of one, my own study, is like, if I'm for some weeks in the US, I gain weight. So it's definitely ingredients. Like, it's like, meaning it's like, again, N of one, but I have many, many other European friends who report the same. Yeah. The stuff is spiked with sugar. You always have to look. It's all worse. Like, I do not like the European Union regulating so much, but I do think they've done a quite okay job to keep very toxic stuff out of the food, and I think the US needs to catch up on that. And I think it's one of the great things of RFK that he's going exactly there and says, look, there is literally something in the water and in the food. And again, as a European spending half of my time in the US, I can totally confirm that. And by the way, the other thing I can confirm, because we did some studies on that, on the whole sort of enjoyment of food, like, it's actually a little bit even worse than you said, because, like, one way these GLP-1s work, so they curb your enjoyment and your craving for food, which is good, but like, it's the same part of the brain which literally creates enjoyment and enthusiasm and appetite in a broader meaning for many other things, not just food, like for adventure, for seeing people, whatever. So, and what we believe and where actually science is going is that sort of that down regulation of that center of the brain, which again produces the intended effect that you want to eat less, might also down regulate your general, let's call it, appetite on life, because because it's a part of the brain which is not just dedicated to eating, which is that side effect where you say people could get depressive, suicidal, just more passive. So I think that is like, I believe the same what you said, these GLP-1s have a value, but like, I think we need to be much more studying how they function in detail, what could be the side effect. And then maybe one last point, which I want to add though positive, is like the big things, what Ozempic and Mounjaro, whatever, what they pioneered and where I'm a big believer in, is kind of body autonomy. Yeah, coming back to what I said before, like our definition of medicine and all of that, I think we should be much more libertarian in looking what is medicine, what do we give it for, not just what I said, not just coming in when people are sick in a classical definition, but allowing people to really say, what do I want? Oh, I want to be slimmer. I should know about all the side effects. I think that's important. But if at the end somebody says, look, that's what I really want, and I don't need to be obese for that. If somebody says, look, I just want to lose weight, let's help them. Like if somebody says, I think the next big thing, and we're going to have a big readout of a private company in some weeks where we found, hopefully, a drug which creates muscle mass with much less exercise. So because so I think that's the next big thing is like after losing weight will be how can people be put on more muscles, like look more ripped. By the way, happiness is another point. As I said before, we're always looking at the state of mind is always somebody depressive or not, but that's such a binary view on the mind, which I don't think is correct. Like I always turn it around. And if I ask here in the chat and would say, hey, who is like truly happy? I don't think a lot of people say, oh, I'm always truly happy. Everybody can be more happy. So why not use psychedelics, not just as a treatment for what we call depression now, but as a general mood enhancer? Like, so I believe a lot. And by the way, that's going to be, I think, a massive new market for pharma and biotech is not just treating what we classically call an illness, but helping people physically and mentally to become the person they really want to be. So to stop here, but I wrote a whole blog post about it because that's one of the topics, like human enhancement, which really excites me. So whoever wants to read it, I'm posting it in the comments now. Check it out. Hopefully you like it.
So that was a beautiful discussion, and I hate to interrupt it, but I do have a few more pretty big topics, especially within the investment conversation line that I want to touch on. So something that was mentioned earlier, I think it was John that mentioned this, there's roughly $175 billion in biopharma revenue expected to go off patent by the end of the decade. And so, John, Christian, M, and Olivia, I'm going to pick on you three for this one. It's kind of a two-parter. So first, can you kind of shed a little light to the listeners today? What exactly happens when a drug goes off patent? What exactly that means? And as the secondary part of this, what will that mean for the monetization of that drug by the original patent holder? And what kind of effects can we see in the broader markets as some of these drugs go off patent? John, could you start us off?
Yeah, I can kind of go high level and then I'll pass it over to Olivia and Christian. But essentially, you know, what that means is that one of the main ways that some of these pharmaceutical companies make money, I mean, a lot of people think that it's from the drug pricing, but there's a lot of money tied up in patents, right? And so what that essentially means is they have, you know, they essentially have the rights to that specific patent, right? And so they, with having that tied up in patent money in the future with that coming off, that's what that's essentially going to mean is there's a lot more money up for grabs from other companies to either jump in and potentially secure patents or for the opportunity for them to get in spaces that they were not able to play in before because there were already patents on there. So I think that, you know, again, it's a very, very big space to track. It's actually something that we're working on behind the scenes at BioPharm Catalyst to try to actually do a better job of tracking these patents, because in a lot of ways, these can be viewed as catalysts to some degree, just because there is so much money tied up in them. Essentially, you know, like I said, that is going to be one main source of revenue for a lot of these companies. And it's going to free up a lot of revenue, the potential for additional revenue for companies that currently are not playing in those spaces. Olivia, Christian, do you have anything to add there?
There are ways to extend that, and some people like are able to a little bit modify the drugs, make better versions, but nothing really to add. I think it's going to be a big driver because like what most pharma companies do, they just have to buy new drugs. So we said that I think John, it was you who said it at the beginning.
Yeah.
That this year will be a lot of M&A, and I actually think I think pharma became, because at the end they don't know more than we do in terms of we like investors, markets, whatever. I think they became very complacent over the last 3 years because biotech stayed low, valuations stayed low for longer than we all thought. So if I talk to pharma people, they're all like, yeah, we're going to make M&A, but like we have time, things are low, whatever. And I think they could be very sort of negatively surprised, positive for all of us here, that we're going to see a year of in 2025 where suddenly biotech stocks completely re-rate. And again, it's a very bullish view, but like once they re-rate, it's very hard to time it, but once they re-rate, you see it in crypto, by the way. I think biotech and crypto has actually more in common than people think. Yeah, when Bitcoin re-rated, you suddenly had a, what did Bitcoin made? It made more than a 4x, 5x from the lows, yeah, or from the interim lows. But like, and I think similar things could happen with small cap biotech stock, that they suddenly, within weeks and months, re-rate, make 2, 3, 4x's, and then pharma will start panicking. Because they're like, oh fuck, we missed the window, yeah. Because they became so complacent, and that could actually then even further drive that re-rating. So that's sort of my bullish view on biotech this year.
Christian M, I saw you unmuted there as well. Do you have something to add to what John and other Christians said?
Yeah. So something to keep in mind is that when like small molecules like they go generic, for instance, like 85% of like the market like price, like it could go down in like less than a quarter, if that makes sense. So that's something just to keep in mind that since like many of these companies like are facing like patent expiration soon, like they need to find the next molecule, the next thing in order to diversify, because otherwise like they'll be facing like a lot of generic drugs, and then those generic drugs, they go into formularies for PBMs where they're like placing the lowest like tier of the formularies. So in the case of that, it's really hard to access many people for those generic drugs, at least in the US, because usually the formularies, they give preference to like more expensive drugs, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and also one further point to add that I forgot to mention before is just the length of time that some of these patents actually last for. I mean, typically some of these can last for 20 years. So the fact that so many are freeing up is kind of a bit in the next, you know, by the end of the decade, as you mentioned, Nick. And I think the quote that I had was like $400 billion was coming up by 2033. That's really a big deal. And it does vary based off of the type of exclusivity that they're granted. For instance, like orphan drug exclusivity grants 7 years of market exclusivity typically for orphan drugs. So it's important to take a look at the type of patent that it is. And there are various types. Obviously, you know, for the drug itself, for the license to sell, you know, for the whether it's specifically small molecule or for what indication it's targeting. So there is more to take a look at when it comes to patents, but it's definitely something, you know, as you're doing your research as a biotech investor, to really pay attention to and take a look. You know, it's something you can do due diligence on, even outside of our website, BioPharm Catalyst, to take a look at, you know, hey, what do these companies really have a right to, and when is that expiring? And is there any plans of them, you know, renewing that patent or extending it, things like that.
Olivia, did you have anything to add to that about the patents?
No, I think we covered our bases.
Fair enough. So I want to touch a little bit on the individual entity side of things, and not to beat a dead horse on GLP-1, but this is just a pretty good example that I had. So Eli Lilly recently disclosed their fourth quarter sales of Zepbound and Mounjaro, and they significantly fell short of Wall Street estimates, and that marked the second consecutive miss for the two drugs. And it sparked a sell-off that same day that took Lilly shares down, I think, just under 7% by close on that same day. Now, at the conference, CEO David Ricks stated, quote, "I believe we're still in the early innings of this." And so, Dr. Fung, before I get some trader input here and some investment input from John and the crew, do you agree with this sentiment? Are we in these early innings of GLP-1 and other obesity, diabetes targeted treatments?
I don't think we're in the early stages. I mean, who hasn't heard of Ozempic? Like, it's everywhere. And like, you can't avoid hearing about it. Every person on the street knows about it. So it's not like we're, you know, got some unknown drug and it's going to go up and up. Everybody who's wants it has gotten it. I mean, it's been years. It's been a couple of years. I think, you know, it's been at least 4 or 5 years. I practice in Canada, so it's been approved here for like 4 or 5 years. Got very popular a couple of years ago, 2022 or so. That's where you saw those big rises. But again, you've got, you know, it's you got saturation of the market. I mean, it's there's only so many people that actually want to do these drugs, and everybody, it was so, you know, so for drugs, you're supposed to get a prescription from a doctor. That's your sort of gatekeeper. That sort of gatekeeper role failed for Ozempic, and you know, that anybody who wanted Ozempic, it didn't matter if it was medically indicated or not. You could go to a medical spa. A friend of mine just said, oh, I get it at the medical spa. So she goes to the spa, gets her, you know, Botox and gets some Ozempic. It's like, and I was sort of appalled as a physician. I was a bit appalled. I was like, these are drugs with real side effects who have, you know, you want somebody monitoring it because you need to know. But no, it had gotten out there. There was that company that Weight Watchers bought, which basically sank them, right? They bought this pill mill for Ozempic, where you could get Ozempic within 5 minutes of taking an online, you know, online interview. So, you know, if you want to get, you know, any other drug, right, you got to see your family doctor. If it's a specialist, you got to get a specialist. They need to do your blood work and make sure it's appropriate. But here we had a situation where 5 minutes on the internet would get you a prescription for Ozempic. So that was the drug sequence. They weren't alone. I mean, all you needed was a bunch of unethical doctors to write a bunch of prescriptions for people they never saw or would ever see again. And you could get it. So, you know, people thought, oh, well, you know, it's going to have this ramp up like regular drugs that go on for years and years. But no, it wasn't that. It was so far out there that it sort of pulled forward, if you will, the normal rise in sort of demand. So the people who didn't want it still don't want it. Then the people who wanted it or have already got it or tried it or whatever. And a lot of people just don't stay on it. So I would sort of disagree from boots on the ground that no, I don't think we're that early. The drug itself has been around. So it's more competition. It's, you know, you've already gotten, you know, I'd say you're in the middle innings, if anything. So there still probably is some growth. I mean, there is, you know, and the studies have been done. Like, you know that there's good benefits in terms of, you know, sleep apnea, and there's weight loss, and there's diabetes, and there's kidney disease and heart disease. So there's all these benefits, but that's already known. Like, you're not going to do another study where you're going to say, wow, this is amazing. I can't believe that this is good for this, right? The studies have already come out. So what's left, right? So it's not that it's not a good drug. It is a good drug. But where's your upside to what it was, right? So everybody assumed that the growth and usage would continue upwards, but that super sharp rise was because of a bunch of unethical doctors giving it to whoever felt like taking it. So you saw this 2-3 year massive spike in growth that was just not sustained because, you know, you circumvented the usual sort of doctors keeping a lid on it. So it's not like a cancer drug. Some cancer drugs, you know, they go up, they're $1 billion, then $2 billion, then $3 billion. So they have this very orderly rise as more and more doctors use it. That wasn't the case. This was not driven by doctors. It was driven by a whole bunch of internet, you know, medical spas and internet, and, you know, people were writing 50, 80, 100 scripts a day. I mean, I knew an obesity clinic. Again, this is just a story about unethical doctors, but they ran an obesity clinic. Doctors were supposed to see 70 patients a day, so that's like 5 minutes a day for like 8 hours straight, right? 5 minutes per patient, And basically you came in, you got your name, you got your blood pressure done, and then you got a script for Ozempic. And there was like 10 doctors in this clinic and it was running for years. So, you know, any demand was just fulfilled right there. So it wasn't hard to get Ozempic as a prescription. Like for a while, it was the limiting factor was how much drug there was. But do I think we're in the beginning? No, it's been around. Like medically, I've been living with Ozempic. Like I've heard about it. Patients have heard about it. Everybody's heard about it. So yeah, I think we're in the middle.
Fair enough. And so kind of with Dr. Funk's comments there in mind, John, Olivia, and or Christian M., kind of, despite its tumble from those 2024 highs, which were pretty up there, a couple hundred bucks up from where we are now, Eli Lilly's still sitting at technically positive 15%-ish since January of last year. And so kind of taking in mind what Dr. Fung has said, his disagreement with what the CEO mentioned at the conference, are investors at all concerned with recent misses by companies with their most popular drugs, or with any companies providing similar products? And kind of to add on to that, are there any companies that BioPharm Catalyst has kind of been watching to break into kind of these upward trajectories that we're looking for with new drug releases and the like?
Yep. I can take that and then I'll pass along to Olivia and Christian from BPC. First of all, I definitely agree with Dr. Fung. I mean, look, it is in the CEO's best interest to generate, some degree of enthusiasm around this, right? Especially when there were misses like Lilly saw, right? And so you do have to keep that in mind and take some of it with a grain of salt. Do I think that it's going to completely drop off the cliff? No, not necessarily, but you have to approach it with some healthy level of skepticism. I think there's a couple things at play that were an issue before and probably will still continue to be an issue. And that is that a lot of these drugs that are on the market for this are injectable. And there were some pretty big manufacturing issues that the Biden administration or that during Biden's tenure that companies faced with being able to properly and efficiently manufacture these drugs. And so there's a little bit of like a supply chain issue there. Some of that was probably spillover from COVID. And to what degree that, you know, gets resolved is still to be seen. So that is something for investors to really keep in the back of their minds. And I think that, you know, there is a scenario where that is likely going to continue. And just on top of that, I mean, there are some folks that just, you know, don't necessarily want to take these medications in an injectable form. They'd rather have them orally. So I think that there's going to be a little bit more of a focus on companies that are manufacturing some of this, manufacturing, you know, the pill version of Ozempic and Wegovy, and being able to take that, orally. So I think that is, those are definitely two areas to take a look at. I also like to draw the parallel, just getting back to the investor confidence piece, right? You have to keep in mind that all of this is related to investor confidence, right? How much confidence and what is the market sentiment around this, right? So even if the results are positive, right, are they as good as investors expected? And there was a lot of hype, with a lot of hype kind of comes, you know, big expectations for the companies to, you know, hit those projections or beat those projections. We see it with earnings, right? And we also see it just with generally speaking in the clinical trial process with Catalyst. So I think a good kind of parallel to that is one question we commonly get at BioPharm Catalyst is, you know, oh, such and such data, phase three data was positive. Why did the stock price go down? Or, you know, such and such drug was approved. Why did the price go down afterwards? Well, the reason is the market has to reasonably assume that that they can then go out and sell that drug, right? They need to make sure that it can be commercialized and that there could, that there actually is some degree of, you know, future revenue forecasting and profitability that would be associated with the drug. If it's something where the market is completely crowded, or the competition is really high, even if the drug was approved, that may not necessarily be a good thing. It's not that much different when we're talking about things like the GLP-1, right? It is expectations versus what is actually going to happen. So I think moving forward, yeah, are these companies going to be able to sustain that growth that they saw, and from doctors possibly over-prescribing this, as Dr. Fung mentioned? Maybe not. Having said that, there are some players, and you asked for a name, you know, Viking Therapeutics comes to mind as a company that had launched into phase three for their GLP-1 drug, and I believe now is in phase two for the oral equivalent of that. And it's a smaller company. So that is one company we've been tracking pretty closely. A lot of investors on our site are tracking that them very closely. And also could be a potential target for, you know, maybe an acquisition. Obviously, we don't know that for sure. But again, getting back to what I said before about later stage companies, proven science, right? That would be an example of, okay, this trial is going into, you know, it's in, it, this drug is going into, is in phase three. It's later stage. The results so far have been fairly good. So it is one that we're keeping an eye on just as it relates to GLP-1 as a whole. Olivia or Christian from my team, any additional thoughts on that?
No, I think you, please go ahead, Olivia.
I was just going to say that I think that you covered the bases pretty well.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. Yeah, I think that's good.
So something I want to touch on real quick here as well, and anyone feel free to chime in, especially John, Olivia, Christian. We've touched very briefly on some of these topics of mergers and acquisitions, consolidation. Jonathan Bush, the CEO and founder of Zeus Health, predicted that 2025 will be a shakedown year for digital health with significant consolidation expected. And Owen Tripp of Included Health also stated that he expects 2025 to be an active year for digital health M&A as well. And so I just, from your bird's eye view there at BioPharm Catalyst, would you agree with that sentiment? Do you think that these mergers and acquisitions are definitely going to see a significant uptick this year? Especially, I ask because there's been some concerns in the industry of increased scrutiny from the FTC and the DOJ in light of recent deals like that aforementioned Johnson & Johnson, just under $15 billion acquisition of Intracellular Therapies.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, again, kind of to what I mentioned before, I do think that we are going to see see an uptick in that. I do think you're going to see consolidation. You know, if we go back several years, we just saw tons and tons of IPOs and tons of biotechs on the market. And the reality is that a lot of them did not, you know, and don't survive. The truth of the matter is that it costs, you know, upwards of billions of dollars in upfront capital to be able to launch a drug and to sustain clinical trials. And on average, it takes, you know, anywhere from 7 to 10 years to get through this. And it's just not really all that possible for a lot of companies. So I do think that that is likely not going to continue, and that some of these companies that are able to prove themselves and prove their sciences are going to be the targets of possible acquisitions. I think I mentioned this earlier as well. Do I think that it's going to be, you know, tons and tons of massive deals like we saw from J&J to the tune of $15 billion? Not necessarily. I still think that those are going to be few and far between, but I do think you are going to have some of the bigger pharma companies really targeting, like I said, companies that have proven science, that have drugs that are in the late stages, and expanding their pipelines that way. And also just, you know, also not to mention private companies, right? We at BioPharm Catalyst, we're really focused on public companies, but I think the acquisition of privately held biotechs is something is something to be aware of. And we actually just recently, weirdly enough, just partnered with a company called Byte 51 to offer some private company data with respect to where companies are at in terms of their clinical trial pipeline. So, you know, for folks who are interested in taking a look at more of the private sector and saying, okay, well, which of these are maybe going to get scooped up from the larger players, you know, we do have some of that information available. But that is really where I think we see it going. I think that, you know, not only, I mean, J&J was one deal, but, you know, Eli Lilly mentioned that they're going to acquire Scorpion Therapeutics with a deal value of $2.5 billion. Again, not quite as big as the $15 billion, but still something that is significant. And then finally, Sage Therapeutics confirmed that they received an unsolicited non-binding offer from Biogen to acquire its remaining shares for $7.22 per share. So those are just kind of three examples right there that we saw from the conference. Again, maybe not all quite as big as that J&J deal, but larger than some of what we had seen in the past where, you know, these companies were scooping up preclinical or phase one companies for, you know, maybe a couple $100 million, you know, to less than $500 million. So I do think that we will see a bit more of that and a bit more consolidation, but curious to hear anyone else's thoughts on that too.
Well said, John. And I know we have seen a lot of things like Teladoc Health announcing its participation in Amazon's health benefits programs. And I do think many topics spoken about at the conference touched on stuff like that as well, which, again, it's not as romantic or exciting as, you know, Johnson & Johnson's $50 billion. But, you know, partnerships like this, I think, just kind of bear a little bit of fruit for the industry as a whole. So what I want to do here at the tail end is, John, I would love to hear a little bit more about what BioPharm Catalyst is working on and some of the things you guys are scoping out over there in your analysis. And, you know, just anything else that you feel we didn't hit that our listeners today should be privy to about what you guys got going on over there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, again, Nick, really appreciate being on. Always enjoy these sessions with you as well as the other panelists. And thank you thank you, Christian and Dr. Fung, for being on as well. I love getting additional perspectives. I think you kind of mentioned it from the beginning. Really, what our goal is as a company is to provide folks with the when of when these key events are going to happen so that people who are trading biotech can take advantage of those trades. I think one of the most common ways that people use our platform is to do things like trade the biotech run-up. So for instance, if you know that a phase two or phase three catalyst, phase two or phase three data is coming out on a particular date, a lot of times what will happen is that stock price will increase in the weeks or even, you know, a month ahead of that catalyst date as investors pile into that trade. And then a lot of times those investors will get out of the trade before the catalyst takes place. And the reason for that is because, and we say this all the time, we don't have a crystal ball. Our job is not to tell folks, okay, this is the stock that you should buy, or this data is going to be positive, or this data is going to be negative, right? We don't have that kind of insight. And anybody who says that they do, they're lying. That just does not exist. Our job is to present you with the objective facts and curate all of the information across, you know, thousands of publicly traded biotech companies and their clinical trial pipelines to let you know when key events that you need to be aware of are going to be taking place that could impact the underlying stock price. So that is really what our mission is and what we're trying to continue to do. As I mentioned, we do have some exciting things on the horizon. We're going to be doing a lot more sessions like this. We actually are, if you guys didn't get enough of this, we're actually doing another one, our own webinar tomorrow, taking place at 4 p.m. Eastern time to do a bit more of a recap on JPM. And we're actually talking with Chef from Chef Station you know, who's a longtime executive in the biotech space and a heavy biotech trader, to get his thoughts. So we're going to try to do a lot more of these sessions to educate folks around what it is that we're doing and our thoughts on the biotech space. I think I mentioned the Byte 51 partnership. So we've actually kind of tapped into the private data market as well. If any folks are interested in that, please feel free to contact us on that. And we're really just looking to continue to deliver accurate and timely information so folks can take advantage of everything that that this space and this industry has to offer. So again, really appreciate the time.
And obviously I appreciate you guys for sponsoring the panel, but, and I say this anytime a sponsor participates in the panel, it's basically crucial from my point of view. You guys' input and your expertise, invaluable to something like this. And the average investor interested in biotech stocks may not have the font of knowledge necessary to fully understand the science and leadership behind any given company. And I definitely fall into that category myself. So having your input, what you guys are working on at BioPharm Catalyst, invaluable. So folks, he mentioned that webinar tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern. If you're at all interested in biotech, if you're at all interested in what BioPharm is doing over there with their analysis, the companies that they're watching, definitely go check that out. You're going to be hard-pressed to find somewhere else where you'll learn more in a shorter amount of time about the industry and how investors are positioning themselves and learning about these companies. You'll be hard-pressed to find a better medium for that than BioPharm Catalyst. So I appreciate it. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, Nick, if that webinar you do have to register for, and we do have that pinned to our Twitter account page. So if you follow us on Twitter, if you go to our page, you should be able to register it via that link. Just wanted to let everyone know. Thank you.
Absolutely beautiful. Definitely check that out, everybody. This will conclude our panel today on that JPM conference and health. Stay tuned for any future panels that Unusual Whales will have. We'll have the FOMC panel coming up on the 29th, I believe. Yep, the 29th. So just be on the lookout there, and obviously follow everybody on this panel if you're at all interested in biotech and biopharma, especially BioPharm Catalyst. I really appreciate having you all here today. I learned a lot. I hope you all did too, and we'll catch you in the next one. Have a great afternoon, everybody.
Thanks for having us. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks all.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.